May it please the court.
You may want to angle. We kind of have a new sound issue, so if you angle it up a little closer, we'd appreciate it. Thank you.
May it please the court. David McNeil was convicted as a prior and persistent offender of burglary in the second degree, Class C felony, and stealing, a Class A misdemeanor, to which he admitted his guilt at trial. He was sentenced to terms of 10 years and 150 days. This post-conviction case follows an evidentiary hearing and Mr. McNeil's claim that his trial attorney acted unreasonably by not requesting, connection with the felony burglary offense, a lesser-included first-degree trespass offense, which would have carried a maximum sentence of 6 months or 180 days. At the evidentiary hearing, Mr. McNeil's trial counsel's testimony demonstrated the following. Trial counsel believed that the felony burglary offense had been overcharged or enhanced, and that belief formed a theory, part of the theory of the defense case. Going into trial, trial counsel believed that obtaining an outright acquittal on the burglary offense would be difficult, or in his words, tough, with Mr. McNeil admitting to the stealing offense. Asked why he didn't request a trespass instruction, trial counsel did indicate that a trespass instruction, quote, didn't seem appropriate, unquote, to him, or didn't seem to fit the facts, seemed to be inconsistent. But counsel also indicated at the evidentiary hearing that he didn't think that there would have been any harm in submitting the lesser included instruction. Asked also why a trespass instruction was not requested, counsel also spoke about being in a certain mindset that Mr. McNeil had taken the drill, but he didn't commit the burglary. Counsel was asked if there was any specific time when he recognized or decided that he would not request a lesser included trespass instruction, and counsel indicated, I'm not sure, quote, I'm not sure that it was much of a conscious decision as much as it just didn't seem appropriate, end quote. Finally, the record from the evidentiary hearing, I think, fairly shows that defense counsel never consulted with Mr. McNeil on the issue of whether to request a lesser included
isn't that the lawyer's decision to make anyway? Aren't matters of trial strategy such as that?
Generally,
most lawyers have tried more cases than most defendants.
Yes, Your Honor, and this, as I conceded in the brief, is not one of those decisions that the case law or even the rules, Rule 4-1.4, I think, would make the exclusive decision of the defendant, such as whether to plead guilty, whether to testify. At the same time, I think that this decision, whether to request a lesser included instruction, is an important decision, and therefore there needs to be a consultation with the defendant. Strickland undoubtedly holds that counsel has a duty to consult with the defendant regarding strategies. And I think that the fact that defense counsel or trial counsel in this case didn't even consult with Mr. McNeil contributes to the unreasonableness of his.
Well, then Mr. McNeil thought he was lawfully in the apartment, though, correct? I mean, wasn't that part of his statement from the get-go?
Well, I mean, in a way, I think maybe going into trial, and again, there was no apparent discussion about the lesser included trespass instruction, but at trial he actually, as the dissent pointed out in the first McNeil, undermined his own, if that was in fact his theory, because he testified that he opened the door and realized that it was empty, and then he stepped in. And so, you know, in that sense, I think the best thing that could be said on behalf of the state in this case to attempt to uphold the motion court's findings are that trial counsel indicated that a trespass instruction would have been inconsistent. But in light of Mr. McNeil's testimony at trial, that he opened the door, saw it was empty, and then stepped in fact, a trespass instruction would not have been inconsistent with the evidence.
You indicate that. You make an allegation that the counsel did not discuss this strategy with his client. Is this something that was in your admitted motion? Is it preserved for us for review?
The state's alleged that it's not preserved. Your Honor, I did not indicate in the amended motion that there was a duty to consult with Mr. McNeil. At the same time, I do feel that this court can consider that. I think there's cases that talk about Wilkes versus State is a 2002 case from this court that talks about the purpose of amended motion is to allow the motion court to intelligently look at an amended motion claim and apply the Strickland standards. The cases that the state cited, Dorsey versus State, was a case where the amended motion alleged, it was DNA, the amended motion alleged that defense counsel was unreasonable for not looking into peak DNA analysis, and that was elicited at the evidentiary hearing, but the amended motion talked about something else, which was a profile for Y chromosome DNA. So they were kind of radically different ideas that in the Dorsey case, and I think the substance of this amended motion concerned pretty plainly that counsel acted unreasonably by not requesting this instruction. I think also, as the state even indicated in a footnote in their brief, the amended motion did plead that had counsel discussed this issue with Mr. McNeil, he would have demanded that. So by necessarily implication, I think it's in
there.
But
you've not made an allegation that counsel is obligated to obtain defendant's input or even follow it.
There was not that specific allegation that it was necessary that he seek his input. I do think by necessarily implication, there is enough in the amended motion that this court could consider that.
Even if the court did not think that it was properly pled and would consider it as a separate claim, that is relevant, is it not, because counsel indicated part of his reasoning for not asking for the instruction was because he thought his counsel would be upset by the instruction, and so he assumed his counsel would be upset, or his client would be upset, rather than communicating with him and talking with him. So his failure to communicate with his client is relevant to whether or not that was a reasonable basis on which not to ask for the instruction.
I believe so. I believe that That is accurate, Your Honor. I think counsel could have, if he had that uncertainty, he could have easily resolved that. And I think there's a duty that counsel has to be an advocate and an assistant to the defendant to discuss important decisions with the client. Even if I don't know even how I would answer the question of whose ultimate decision-making power is that? And I think, in fact, it could be the trial counsel's ultimate decision responsibility. But nevertheless, through consultation with the defendant, there develops different strategies. There develops, it's important to have a meaningful discussion about strategies with the defendant.
Along the same lines, counsel thought that trial court, he didn't know if the trial court would have submitted an instruction. Is it reasonable for counsel to make that assessment without offering the instruction and having it accepted or refused?
Absolutely not. I think that's not reasonable. I think if counsel didn't request it because, and this is true, several times in the evidentiary hearing he went back to the idea that he didn't think the trial court would have submitted the instruction, so he, quote, wasn't inclined to ask for it. And I don't think that's reasonable to then not ask for it. I think reasonable counsel, uncertain about whether the court would submit it or not, would request it, wouldn't decide the issue for him or
herself.
The
trial court could have offered it on its own if it thought it was.
Could have, but but again, that goes to
the trial court. Can the trial court do that if neither party wants it? That's a side issue. Go ahead. Sorry.
The answer is yes.
Well, in any event, I think Mr. McNeil's counsel had an obligation to protect him from the, and the kind of larger claim is the exposure that Mr. McNeil had in this case by not having a lesser included instruction. So whether or not the court would have submitted that instruction or could have submitted that instruction, I think counsel was unreasonable by not requesting it. He left. He knew it was difficult to win the burglary case. He acknowledged that. He thought it would be difficult. He simultaneously also knew that Mr. McNeil would be convicted of a Class A misdemeanor. So then why not submit a even lower class misdemeanor rather than just leave Mr. McNeil on the hook for a term of up to 15 years where he was going to have a sentence, a conviction for an A misdemeanor that would have carried 1 year.
Counsel, let me just ask you a quick question. If on, in terms of the duty to talk to the client, how does that work, though, when the lens in which we have to analyze this is whether it was objectively reasonable? Not subjectively, but objectively, in terms of the strategy that was employed here.
Well, I think, objectively, an attorney needs to understand and find out. I think strategy, this court's analyzing strategy or a post-conviction case analyzes strategy, I think that's almost meaningless without an idea of what that strategy is. And how do you get an idea of what that strategy is? Whether to win at all costs, was Mr. McNeil stoic and he, holding the state to its case? Was he extremely principled and the state charged this wrong? And so, I want to put them to the test. Or did he maybe want to limit his exposure in terms of a longer sentence by requesting a Class B misdemeanor? And I think counsel.
Why isn't this one of those cases where both of them would have been a reasonable trial strategy, objectively?
Well, I think the record of the evidentiary hearing doesn't show any strong or good reason for not requesting it. I think counsel acted unreasonably under the facts and circumstances of this case.
Thank you.
May it please the court. Counsel testified at the evidentiary hearing that he opted not to request the instruction for trespass as a matter of trial strategy because he was employing an all or nothing defense as to count one while conceding guilt on count two in an effort to obtain an acquittal on count one. Counsel testified that he felt it would be inconsistent with his defense, which happened to be predicated upon his own client's testimony, to request the trespass.
And was he incorrect on the law in that regard?
That it would be inconsistent? Well, factually, it's inconsistent to say that, on the one hand, he didn't knowingly enter unlawfully, and on the other hand, he did knowingly enter unlawfully. So, factually, it is inconsistent.
But was it inconsistent with his client's explanation of what he did?
Yes. His client said that he thought he could enter because he had a relationship with Tracy, who lived at this apartment, and he believed he could knock and enter. And so, factually, it would be inconsistent for counsel to then stand up and say, he knowingly entered unlawfully. Now, is it possible to adopt a strategy whereby counsel, say, hedges his bets with the jury and says, well, my client said, he thought he was entering a friend's home. He thought he could knock. He thought he could go in. He was surprised when he... Is it possible that counsel could then submit trespass in the first degree and not affirmatively argue for that conviction and still argue for an acquittal on count one and concede guilt on count two and thereby sort of hedge his bets, thinking maybe the jury isn't going to be convinced as count one? Counsel could probably do that as well. That could be a different objectively reasonable standard strategy to employ.
But if we look at this, go ahead and make.
I was just going to say, but if there are multiple strategies that could be employed reasonably under circumstances, counsel gets to make that choice. And the court in Strickland said that high deference is given to trial counsel in making that strategic determination. Pardon me, Your Honor.
He did inquire as to the officer whether his entering the apartment could constitute trespass. So how does that, those questions and those responses fit into a reasonable trial strategy?
Well, I don't know that he asked, I wouldn't say that he asked specifically about his client's entry.
Right, I'm sorry.
But a hypothetical person's entry being, that could be a trespass. And I think that asking the hypothetical question does a couple of things. First of all, I think, you know, if you have a situation where counsel, and granted, you know, the evidentiary hearing was about 6 years after the trial, and so counsel, I think, had to reconstruct as best he could his thought processes about what was going on at trial. But there are a couple of reasons why you might ask a question like that. Because mid-trial, you might be thinking and weighing, which way am I going to go? Am I going to go for all or nothing, or am I going to hedge my bets, say?
And but, so, but those questions advise the jury
sure.
that it was likely a crime for him to go into the apartment under the circumstances that he laid out for the jury.
If they didn't believe his client's testimony that he didn't knowingly enter unlawfully, the hypothetical presupposes an unlawful entry. The hypothetical that was posed to the officer. But that wasn't what the defendant testified to, nor was that what counsel argued in closing. Counsel argued both that he didn't have the intent to commit stealing when he entered and that he didn't know that he was entering unlawfully.
You were arguing that in this case, the all-or-nothing trial strategy is appropriate, but isn't it true that in some cases an all-or-none trial strategy would not be appropriate?
Your Honor, I could say without referring to specific facts that there might be a case out there where an all-or-nothing strategy would be inappropriate, where it would be unreasonable. I think it's difficult to hypothesize, though, in any given case after the fact, whether it would be unreasonable without concrete facts. And here's why. You know, when counsel is looking at the decision whether to go all-or-nothing or to go some other strategy, counsel has to take into effect many things that are not apparent from the record on review later. For instance, if counsel is presenting the case and counsel questions the police officer and brings out this possibility about trespass, but then counsel presents testimony of the defendant and counsel watches the jury and the jury's nodding and they appear to be agreeing with the defendant and believing his story, I think under those circumstances, counsel might say, you know what? I think we should stick with this. I'm going to put everything on the jury believing, crediting my client's testimony, and I'm going to go with all or nothing because I think I have this jury.
What is it significant? Is it part of our analysis that he testified it was not a conscious decision not to submit this instruction, which counters that the argument that it was trial strategy?
I think it's not part of the analysis for a couple of reasons. One, the question that was posed to counsel is, was there a specific point in time in trial when you decided not to request the instruction? And I think that, counsel responded to that, well, I'm not sure there was a conscious decision. And I think he was referring to, was there a specific point in time? Of course, there is a point in time when that happened. He wouldn't have necessarily recalled that. But the assessment and development and application of a trial strategy is often a very organic process that occurs over the course of a trial, and at some point you make that call, and counsel couldn't identify that. But here's the second reason why I don't think it really factors into this court's decision-making. The fact-finding was done by the motion court in this case, and the motion court credited counsel's testimony that he employed a strategy, an all-or-nothing strategy, because he believed it was inconsistent with his chosen defense. Now, counsel may have had other reasons, expressed other doubts about, for instance, whether the trial court would have given the instruction. But that was a doubt that wasn't tested, but it was in addition to counsel's primary reason of, I thought it was inconsistent with the defense that we were doing, and so I wasn't inclined to ask for that instruction. That's what he said. I wasn't inclined to ask for that instruction because what we were arguing was that he didn't unlawfully enter and he didn't have the intent. And so the motion court had to sort out the import of counsel's testimony. And of course, counsel was testifying at a point in time 6 years after trial. And so I imagine that the motion court took that into account in assessing counsel's credibility and making its finding that counsel did in fact employ a trial strategy. And based on the evidence that was presented at the hearing, The motion court's determination in that regard was not clearly erroneous and should be entitled to deference. Mr. McNeil makes the point that, you know, by employing this strategy, counsel simply left him on the hook for the longer sentence. But if counsel's strategy was based and premised on the idea that the jury was going or was perhaps inclined to believe his client, then if they had been, you know, I think it's reasonable for counsel to consider that and say, well, if they had been inclined to not find him guilty of burglary on count one and find him guilty of, say, simple trespass, well, there exists the same probability as a psychological matter that they won't find him guilty of anything on count one, and they'll just enter the conviction on stealing count two. The strategy here of employing all or nothing has to be viewed in terms of the broader context of the case, which is that there were two counts. And so if you had just one count, the middle ground argument, I think, is a more powerful argument for Mr. McNeil, because if you take away the middle ground entirely, it makes the strategy seem less reasonable. But there was middle ground in the case
as a
whole.
But he had admitted to the stealing, so that really wasn't...
That's right. He admitted the stealing because he wanted to expressly give the jury the middle ground that he wanted the jury to take. And by conceding the stealing, I think it's a common strategy, you concede something for the jury to garner credibility and to persuade them that we are telling you the correct story. We are telling you the story that you should credit. You shouldn't credit the state's allegations. They overcharged the defendant. Here is the appropriate middle ground. So by giving them the middle ground on stealing, counsel took a broader view of the case rather than just count one. Because I agree, if this were a single count and counsel had eliminated the middle ground altogether, it seems less reasonable, unless there are other facts in the case, like counsel believed, hey, I thought they really were going to credit my guy's testimony, or the evidence was weak. But that's not what we have here. We have two counts, one of which provides an alternative middle ground for counsel to stake his claim.
Is that affected by the jury's question as to whether he had to form his intent to steal before or after he went in, that they were focusing on the intent with which he entered, and that's the way in which trespassing is different than burglary?
I think not at all, nor could it, because counsel wouldn't have had that question at the time he formed and employed his trial strategy. The trial strategy has to be employed long before that question ever comes from the jury. So the reasonableness of counsel's decision can't take into account anything that occurred after the submission or non-submission. Well, nor do I think that it, oh, I'm sorry, Your
no,
Honor.
No, go ahead.
Nor do I think that that question actually bears upon the question that Mr. McNeil raises of whether he was prejudiced by the lack of submission. Because by asking, does he have to have the intent, that merely shows that the jury was carefully considering the jury instructions. And I think that if they, you know, they were probably told, I don't recall specifically from the record, but they were probably told, continue your deliberations, you must be guided by the instructions. Well, a careful reading of the instructions, which I presume the jury went back and did after the response, leads them to see that he has to have that intent at the time he enters, because he has to enter with that purpose. And so I presume that the jury conscientiously carried out its duties, continued to deliberate, figured out what they needed to determine, and found it. Now, if hypothetically a trespass instruction had been given to the jury, it wouldn't have given them any further instruction about when that intent needed to be formed. It would have simply pointed out, by inference and deduction, that you don't have to have that intent for trespass. But it wouldn't have given them further instruction about when the intent had to be informed. That was their question. When does the intent have to be informed? Well, by reading the instruction itself, they could discern that, and I presume that they did.
In looking at your brief, and I don't have the transcript in front of me, the language that he used in testifying regarding his relationship with Tracy, you report is that he had been in her apartment plenty of times. He testified, I knocked on the door, opened, hey Tracy, but that's the relationship we had. He previously testified that he had an acquaintance with her and that he opened the door and said, hey Tracy. I don't read that as saying he believed he had the right to enter the apartment, that he was saying the relationship was it was okay to open the door and yell for, and that he then went in, he was surprised to see it empty, and then stepped in. Is there any testimony from him that did expressly say he thought he had a right to enter, or is it an inference?
You're correct, Your Honor. He did not expressly testify, I had a right to enter. And that's not a necessary inference that has to be drawn from his testimony, but I think that is the inference, although but closing argument shows that that's the inference that counsel drew and urged the jury to draw from his testimony. So could it have been, could counsel have argued some other inference? Certainly. Could the evidence have been weighed differently by counsel in determining whether to take this route or this route? Certainly. Absolutely, Your Honor. And I think that's one reason why the court in Strickland emphasized that deference has to be given to counsel, because counsel is in the position of looking at the evidence as it has been presented at trial and making that decision on the spot. And either one might have been reasonable under the circumstances of this case. I think I could very easily take the position and stand up and say the other course of action would have been reasonable. And I think I can even concede that. But the choice of one reasonable strategy to the exclusion of another reasonable strategy doesn't mean that counsel's ineffective. It means that counsel simply chosen one strategy over another. In Strickland, the court made plain that there might be 100 different ways. I don't know if they use the word 100, but there might be many different ways to represent an individual client in a given case, and that seasoned trial attorneys just might do it differently. I think that was all I had to say on that point, Your Honor. If there are no other questions.
Thank you.
It's also the state's contention that in addition to showing that counsel's performance was deficient, that the defendant would have to show prejudice. And for the reasons outlined in my brief, I would urge the court to find that there was no prejudice.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Briefly, Your Honor, the fact that there's 100 ways to different ways to defend it doesn't mean, I mean, the state, if you follow that argument too closely, then, I mean, any one of those 100 strategies is therefore okay because, you know, it's one among 99 others. I think you really have to assess the reasonableness of this, and I think the strongest reason, if you can call it the strong, from counsel's reason at the evidentiary hearing was that he believed that it would have been not appropriate. In fact, he was wrong about that. It did fit with the facts. And so counsel's maybe best reason at the evidentiary hearing was just factually wrong. His other reasons, I think,
Judge Ardini asked the question as to whether it was an objective test. So it is as to whether or not it's objectively reasonable. Does that mean we don't look at his reasoning?
It's objective, but I think it takes on the individual knowledge of the attorney. So it's an objective to counsel and the circumstances which this counsel found himself in. And so, you know, in this case, counsel believed that because Mr. McNeil was going to be admitting to the stealing at trial, that he was going to have difficulty obtaining an outright acquittal on that. And I think that, you know, is one of the stronger arguments why if he had this doubt that he was going to be unsuccessful in obtaining this acquittal, then why not ask for the lesser included instruction? If there are no other questions.
Thank you. Case will be submitted.